Welcome to The Bridge. Fun conversations on culture, life, and everything in between.
Find us where you get your podcasts. If you like the show, then consider pushing the like button or giving us 5 stars. Suggestions, comments, anything you would like to share, email us at welovethebridge@gmail.com. We love The Bridge. Today we have a very special guest. Carlos Martinez is author of The East Is Still Red. I have a copy right here. Published by Praxis Press. They prefer if you download it on their website. He is the co-editor of Friends of Socialist China, which also has a YouTube at Friends of Socialist China. You can find Carlos on X at @agent_of_change, agent of change. Carlos has been interviewed by China's prestigious Global Times and various other media. Welcome to the show, Carlos. How are you doing today?
Thanks very much, Jason. Yeah, I'm doing pretty well, thank you. Early over here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So you were in London, right?
Yeah, that's right.
We are a chat show. We would like to learn a little bit about you. So could you tell us a little bit about your relationship with China? We really like to hear the story of people's first time coming to China.
Right, sure. So I'm an author and a researcher and a campaigner based in London, as we've said. I've written the book that you just showed, The East Is Still Red. I am a founding co-editor of Friends of Socialist China, which we launched in 2021, just coming up for 3 years anniversary, kind of, you know, as a response to what felt was a stark and rising misunderstanding and misrepresentation of China in the media, and including on the left, you know. So we wanted to put forward these ideas of China as being like a force for peace, a force for cooperation in humanity's shared project of preventing climate breakdown and promoting development and promoting peace. And we also wanted to discuss the idea of China as a socialist country and based on a Marxist worldview and with the sort of needs and aspirations of ordinary people as its kind of guiding force. In terms of my first trip to China, that was December 2019 through to January 2020. Actually flew back to London on the 8th of January 2020, just as the media was starting to fill up with stories about this new virus coming out of Wuhan. I remember distinctly people were saying to me, I bet you're glad you're not in China anymore. You know, I bet you're glad you're back here in London. A couple of months later, as it was clear that China really had the virus under control, and it was really not under control in Britain and in the US and in Europe, and we were locked down for long periods of time, and you know, Christmas was cancelled 2 years running and stuff like that, I thought to myself, do you know what? China would be an awful lot better of a place to be right now. Going to China for the first time, I mean, you know, landing in Beijing, I went on a sort of Belt and Road study tour. So the focus was on kind of the western parts of China. We went, you know, landed in Beijing, but then went to Xi'an, went to Dunhuang, and went to Urumqi in Xinjiang. You know, landing in Beijing, I think you can't fail to be impressed. You know, it's a mega city, right? It's gone from 1 million population really not very long ago, probably 4 decades ago, that it had 1 million inhabitants. Now it's a mega city of 20 million inhabitants, but it's grown in a like surprisingly orderly way. Like it's very clean, it's very well organized. You know, if you compare it with typical urban sprawl in the West, I guess the quintessential example would be like Los Angeles, where it's just, you know, it's grown in a completely chaotic and, you know, kind of anarchic way. Beijing is like, it's expanded, but, you know, people set up new communities and the government builds roads going up there, builds, you know, links it to the metro line, builds a school, builds a medical clinic. And so people's, you know, needs are met and the city continues to function. And, you know, one thing I remember being kind of almost startled by was not seeing homelessness and not seeing beggars, you know, especially for a massive Asian city, you know, in a developing country. If you compare it with India, for example, I mean, my father's Indian, I've been to India many times. You don't have to walk very far outside Indira Gandhi International Airport to see people experiencing, you know, pretty extreme poverty. And to be honest, you know, I'm here in South London. I could walk, you know, probably 100 meters from my apartment and see significant poverty. So to see kind of the achievements of the anti-poverty campaign up front and so visible kind of brought it home how amazing of an achievement that is. In general, you know, Beijing is a great, very thriving, very vibrant system. City, like the metro system, is excellent, far better than, again, where I am in London, certainly far better than New York City. I remember 2019, I went to Beijing for the first time, and a few months before that, I went to New York City for the first time. You know, New York City is a great city, but, you know, it's kind of falling apart. It's like what makes it great is the different communities and, you know, its cultural contribution over the generations. But, you know, if you compare it in things like roads and parks and railway and all the rest of it, it's like 20, 30 years behind Beijing, which is very interesting to see. Xi'an, again, another beautiful city, really kind of unique and interesting blend of modern and ancient. Dunhuang was, you know, a really fun place to visit. You know, we're out in the middle of the desert in Gansu. Really impressed to see huge solar farms there and to get a glimpse of what China's doing in terms of developing renewable energy. And again, impressive to be in like a pretty small provincial town. I don't remember what the population is, but it's like well under a million. And you're traveling by public transport. It's got a very efficient public transport system, and it's all based on electric buses, which is, you know, still yet to be rolled out in most of the West. Urumqi, of course, was extremely interesting. Spent 3 or 4 days there, and, you know, if nothing else, to kind of counter the relentless propaganda in relation to, you know, so-called human rights abuses in Xinjiang, to see, you know, people living very ordinary lives, to see how many mosques there are, to go into Uyghur restaurants and to see that they're like expressing their culinary culture. You know, if you go into a Uyghur restaurant in Xinjiang, they don't serve alcohol, they don't serve pork, etc. You know, these are perfectly normal things. But if you read the Western press, or even if you're just exposed to the Western press, then you have you assume that people don't have kind of cultural and religious freedoms in Xinjiang, but, you know, they clearly do. And then you notice all the road signs are in Chinese, Uyghur language, and a lot of them English as well. And you see people reading newspapers that are in the Uyghur language. So yeah, all in all, I mean, I guess I was only in China that time for 2 weeks, but yeah, it was a very extremely impressive and informative visit.
Well, you touched on so many of the things I wanted to talk about, but, you know, it also gave me some of the things that I remember about that period of time. So as you were leaving, going back to London, and everyone was, you know, a lot of foreigners actually were also leaving. So, you know, they were English teachers and stuff. They were worried about getting cut off from their parents. And so they were like, oh, we're going back home. I actually moved to Wuhan because they needed people there. They were like, there are a lot of opportunities for career growth there. So I moved into Wuhan, and it quickly, after a few months, became one of the safest places in the world. So it was kind of like the opposite of what everybody anticipated. And then suddenly all of my friends who were living abroad were like, I wish I had stayed in China. And then, you know, they became basically cut off because flights to China, flights to between most countries around the world became very challenging. You know, you touched on Xinjiang. I want to come back around that later. I was hoping, you know, you started off your answer to the question by talking about how you kind of founded Socialist Friends of China in 2021, I believe you said. But could you prompt us, expand on why you decided to study China in the first place?
I mean, personally, like, I've always been very interested in China. I mean, I'm one of three kind of founding co-editors, the others being Danny Haifong and Keith Bennett. Danny Haifong, obviously in New York City, Keith Bennett also here in London. Yeah, I've always been quite interested in China. I mean, I grew up in a leftist family where, I guess, support for socialist countries was considered more or less normal, which is very unusual in Britain. Yeah. And support for anti-imperialist movements like Edgar Snow's Red Star Over China. I read that as a teenager. And then getting older, getting involved myself in politics and in campaigning and operating kind of basically within the Western left in the anti-war movement, in progressive movements, in peace movements, in environmental movements, I just, you know, noticed that people don't really have a very strong understanding of China. I guess there's part of the movement of part of the left over here that had maybe been like on the Soviet side in the Sino-Soviet split, and they'd kind of, you know, written China off. Then, of course, you had groups of Maoists, like very left-wing, who just considered that after Mao's death and after the introduction of reform and opening up in 1978, then China had just gone down a capitalist path. And now it's just another capitalist country. And you can put it in the same category as the United States and Britain. And that's kind of the general consensus, or I think it's changing now, but it was the general consensus that China is just another capitalist country. And, you know, the problem with that as a leftist is that if China's just another capitalist country, how do you explain its achievements in terms of raising people's living standards, in terms of, you know, eliminating absolute poverty, in terms of making progress on the environment, in renewable energy, in biodiversity, in pollution, in electric vehicles, and so on? How do you explain that China's the only country in the world since they started measuring Human Development Index, HDI, to go from a low level to a high level? How do you explain the fact that China has emerged as, you know, a science and technology powerhouse? And again, it's really the only country, certainly the only large country that's done that. To go from being, you know, a developing country to a country that's kind of on the cusp of being a developed country, a modernized country. You know, and yes, obviously inequality has increased massively in China, but so has people's living standards, including at the very bottom of society. You know, practically everyone lives significantly better than they did in China 40 years ago, or indeed, you know, 20 and 10 years ago. You know, if capitalism can achieve all of those things, then we need to revisit, you know, our Marxism. We need to revisit these ideas of historical materialism and the ideas of capitalism giving way to socialism. You know, if capitalism can achieve lifting 800 million people out of poverty, then capitalism's kind of not as bad as we thought. So, you know, I got to studying China in a more serious way myself, essentially in order to be able to help explain it to others. And that was really, you know, the motivation for setting up Friends of Socialist China, running the website, organizing the webinars, writing, you know, the book that East is Still Red, and organizing the trip that we're starting tomorrow, the Friends of Socialist China delegation to China.
Well, you know, you brought up a couple of things I wanted to talk about later, but since they're already in the discussion now, maybe we should address them now. So that is the discourse online when I'm talking about China. And people will say, well, you know, oh yeah, of course China was able to raise hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. It's become capitalist. So what is your response to that discourse?
So I think, you know, the best example and the best comparison would be India, because India is a capitalist country. And in the late 1940s, so India, was freed from British colonialism in 1947. China won its liberation in 1949, both at the time, you know, more or less ruined, economically speaking, and in terms of development. And both, you know, countries of a similar size, certainly in population terms, both now at a population of 1.4 billion. But their trajectories since liberation have been quite different. You know, India in many ways has done very well. It has advanced, it has developed, but there's incredible poverty still remaining in India. Its per capita GDP is, I think, one-fifth or one-quarter that of China's. There's still 25% of the population that goes without access to modern energy, so it doesn't have, you know, electricity and gas in their homes. There's still a significant proportion of the population that doesn't get a decent education. You know, I think the literacy rate in India is 75%, whereas in China it's more like 95%, which is, you know, it's functionally they've wiped out illiteracy. You know, the literacy rate in China is higher than it is in the United States. Actually, life expectancy now, as you know, is higher than it is in the United States. Life expectancy in China is about 10 years higher than it is in India. Development and China's economic growth has been very much directed towards the needs of the people, and is meeting those needs very well. Whereas, you know, and if socialism should do anything, it should be to make people's lives better and to put an end to that sort of desperate poverty. Well,
that is actually a really good example. I think one of the things I like to note about, and I can't make comparison with India, I don't know all the details about India's economy, is that there are a lot of socialist programs in China that are obvious, you know, outside, like job programs, technical skill programs, early retirement, maternity leave, a lot of the things that are associated with, you know, taking social welfare programs are very taken very seriously. There is a tax redistribution program in China, like in some Western countries now, which have actually adopted some forms of socialism just to survive, because it's necessary to take some money from the wealthy and give that back to the lower classes in some way to make, you know, inequality less apparent. But that's much more advanced here in China than it is in a lot of Western countries, despite the fact that GDP per capita in China is, in fact, lower than in the United States. The Gini index is actually narrowing in China, and it's not in the United States. But I want to move on. You mentioned coming to China again for a fact-finding tour. You leave tomorrow. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're going to be doing in China during this trip?
Sure. So it's Friends of Socialist China study tour, the first Friends of Socialist China study tour. It's being set up in coordination with the Chinese NGO Network for International Exchanges. There are 15 of us, mainly from Britain, a couple from the US, a couple from Ireland, a couple of people that you'd be familiar with are joining: Danny Haifong from the US, Margaret Kimberley from the US. We're going to be going to Beijing, having some interesting meetings there with various people from the party, from the party school, from NGOs, from publishers, and so on. We're going to travel to Zhejiang and do a little bit of red tourism, go to the red boat and whatnot. And then we're going to head up to the far northeast to Jilin, to close to the border with the DPRK. The overall focus is on Chinese Marxism, modernization, and your concepts such as common prosperity, rejuvenation of the Northeast. I'm sure we'll be looking at once we're in Jilin. So yeah, it should be a really interesting trip. 10 days. I'm very much looking forward to it.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. I would actually, if I didn't have a full-time job, I'd love to accompany you guys in some capacity. You know, you mentioned Xinjiang earlier, and I think it's one of the hot topics that is being discussed a lot, very often in social media, at least. So in your interview with the Global Times, you said, quote, many people believe the media's disgraceful slanders, including the suppression of human rights in Xinjiang, among others, end quotes. Could you tell us about your personal experience of traveling to Xinjiang? And maybe a little bit about, as you know, someone living in the UK, how does Western media distort or misrepresent real life in Xinjiang?
I mean, you know, the Western media's presentation of China in general and Xinjiang in particular is that of being like a highly authoritarian, highly repressive police state, essentially, where people have no democratic rights, they have no religious freedoms, they have no kind of cultural expression. You know, the CPC sends them to work and to do whatever tasks it requires of them, and then they return to home, to, you know, to their homes to live in squalor and so on. I think that's the kind of overwhelming media perception. It's a part of a propaganda war narrative. And I often say that, you know, propaganda war is a type of war propaganda, because it's actually trying to get the public in the West on side with the new Cold War, with this rising campaign of encirclement and containment of China, and potentially, you know, on board with a military attack on China in the future. You know, there's elements within US imperialist circles and British imperialist circles who are thinking about that eventuality in the not too distant future. So, you know, it's a anti-communist propaganda war. It feeds into a kind of underlying Sinophobic racism, you know, a sort of Fu Manchu narrative of these evil, inscrutable Chinese who are hell-bent on world domination. You know, these are ideas that came up, you know, originally around the ideas around the period of the Opium War. So in the 1840s, to kind of justify what we were doing in relation to China, you know, waging war for Britain's right to push opium on the Chinese population. Those racist concepts about Chinese people still exist to some degree and are still leveraged to generate anti-China hostility when that's what the media wants. So, you know, to contrast Xinjiang, what you actually see, the reality of Xinjiang, with what you read and see in the media, it's, you know, it's kind of night and day. You know, it's an extremely pleasant place to visit, and I would strongly encourage people to visit it, because if you're in China, it's not at all difficult to travel to Xinjiang. You can get there by high-speed rail. You can get there by domestic flight very cheaply. You know, we only went to Urumqi, didn't go to Kashgar, didn't go to other areas of Xinjiang. So we didn't have like a comprehensive trip, and it wasn't a fact-finding trip as such. But, you know, we walked around freely. We went to shops, we went to restaurants. We saw people, you know, dancing in the streets, you know, including doing traditional Uyghur dancing. We saw in parks, as you see everywhere in China, as far as I can tell, in parks, people, you know, doing Qigong, singing and dancing and all the rest of it. And it's, you know, very clean and green. What was when we got to Urumqi, the metro system had just launched, which is, you know, very impressive. If you consider that Urumqi as a city is, you know, just a few hundred miles away from other major capitals in Central Asia. I mean, it feels like an incredibly advanced place. You know, I mean, China and Xinjiang shares a border with Afghanistan, which is, you know, if you like, Afghanistan's witnessed a US-style development model for Central Asia, which is, you know, 20 years of war with another 20 years of awful destabilization and proxy war before that. And the country is a mess. You know, the US does what the US does everywhere, which is turn countries that are on their own development path into failed states and basket case states, you know, just as the US has done in Libya, for example. So whereas Xinjiang is a thriving and modern city, which is full of character, one thing that you really notice is a concentration of mosques, which is kind of unparalleled, I think, statistically. Xinjiang, in terms of number of mosques per Muslim population, is one of the, you know, one of the best performers in the world. And yeah, you see people living their ordinary lives, and including you see, I think, a level of kind of interethnic harmony, that you see people who look Han Chinese and you see people who look Uyghur and you see people who look Kazakh, and they're working together and hanging out together. You know, I think you're struck by the normality of it, you know, because you've been primed to think that it's going to be a really scary and repressive and authoritarian situation where different communities are at loggerheads, and it's not like that.
I get to travel there for, I don't know, about 10 days. And we went to, I don't know, 6 or 7 different cities. And, you know, I wasn't just surprised to see that there was Chinese and Uyghur on signs, on menus, on elevator, you know, warnings everywhere. A couple of the times I was further away from Urumqi. I was further away in the south, in the desert, like in Pishan and some other smaller cities and smaller regions. And sometimes the languages would be in 3 different languages on signs. And I was really surprised by that, because it would be like Chinese, and then there would be 2 different versions of Arabic script from 2 different languages. And I was trying to ask other people that were with me, what's this other language that, you know, and they're like, I don't know what that is. It's just some other. Because so there's so many different ethnic groups in Xinjiang that, so it's a really surprising. One of the arguments that's made in the West is that there's an erasure of language and erasure of culture. And that's clearly not the case when you're there, because not only is Uyghur language being preserved and being used by people on the streets and on signage and so forth, but other ethnic minority groups' languages are also represented on signage throughout the areas in which they live. So I was not just surprised that it was like Chinese and Uyghur. I was really surprised that there was an overall integration of as many minority languages as could be integrated in relative regions where there were larger concentrations of those minorities. But I mean, one of the things that I noticed in Urumqi, I got to walk around at night a couple of nights, was I went to a town square where people were dancing, you know, like they do in China. Every city, there's people dancing at night. So there's this other argument. Why is everyone always dancing? So come to any Chinese city in the evening and everyone is dancing at any. Go to Shenzhen, go to Beijing, go to Shanghai. Old ladies, old men, people of all ages, they're dancing. There's different music in different town squares. It's not just happening in Xinjiang. But when you go to Xinjiang, and I went to Urumqi, we went to this big square. And there was like, I don't know, hundreds of people there. And they were all in different enclaves. And there was like modern hip hop dance. There was like 50 people doing that. And then there was some like Uyghur dancing. And there was like 50 people doing that. And there was like, you know, different grannies doing old school Chinese, like, you know, 1960s and 70s music dancing. So, you know, the narrative that, oh, everyone is just paid to dance. No, you know, you go to any town in any square, any province in China, you're going to find people dancing in the evening. It's a cultural phenomenon for this entire country. Another thing that I noticed in right next to this square, I was just walking around and I found a bunch of people, you know, 20-year-old males just playing basketball. So if, you know, the stories are true about, you know, people being thrown into some sort of camps, right? Why are there like, you know, military age, right? Men who are just out doing whatever they want, like speaking Uyghur and playing basketball and having a good time together. Wouldn't they be the category of people that would be tucked away or something? So it's clearly very apparent being on the ground that the Western narrative is not an accurate representation of real life in the region.
Yeah, it's a completely invented narrative. And on the languages question, I think that's really interesting to make a comparison with the West, because how well does the West do typically with preservation of indigenous languages? How well does the US do? How many people learn Iroquois or any number of indigenous languages that have essentially been wiped out along with indigenous culture and yeah, in many cases, indigenous, you know, whole indigenous communities and peoples? Whereas China, yeah, ever since the founding of New China in 1949, has taken its minorities policy extremely seriously and has made very, very strong, very active efforts to preserve minority cultures and minority languages. You know, like Uyghur language is learned not only by Uyghur people, but it's studied extensively, and there's a very active effort to keep it alive. You know, Uyghur, as you know, is one of the five languages which is included on Chinese banknotes, for example. So, and you know, the whole idea of genocide or cultural genocide, it's like a completely invented narrative. And the awful irony of it right now, when there's a genocide actually going on in Gaza, is that the Western media won't call that a genocide, but they will call anti-terrorism measures in China a genocide. You know, to the point that just a couple of months ago, there was a session at the UN Human Rights Council where a group of Western countries accused China of committing genocide in Xinjiang. One of the countries that signed up to that was Israel. You know, meanwhile, you know, here we are 6 months after the 7th of October, and over 33,000 people have been confirmed killed, probably more like 40,000 out of a population of 2.2 million in Gaza. And, you know, people are literally moving into famine conditions. In a sense, you know, obviously it's utterly horrifying what's going on there and incredibly sad. But it is helping people to understand the fallacious nature of this narrative on China. You know, it's making people think, okay, if the media is not telling us the truth about Gaza, and if politicians aren't telling us the truth about Gaza, maybe they're not telling us the truth about China either. And maybe they're not telling us the truth about Russia either.
Well, there are several Arab delegations from Muslim countries that have gone to Xinjiang, and we've seen that in the media. I have a person that's going to be a guest on this show in a few weeks, Hussein Askari. He's a Baghdadi from Iraq who's living in Sweden, working with the Schiller Institute. He's in Xinjiang now, and he has already shown like videos, along with, you know, obviously lots of people on Douyin and Xigua and all of these Chinese platforms every day who are sharing video of real life in Xinjiang that obviously is at odds with the Western narrative. So, I mean, I want to move on a little bit. I know that you are interested in the underdeveloped world and what, you know, Euro-American colonialism for the last several hundred years has done to half of the world. And I was wondering, how do you see China as supporting development in what is sometimes called the global South?
Sure. I mean, the basic nature of it is that China's providing the means for countries to break out of underdevelopment. And, you know, these chains of underdevelopment were put in place during the colonial era by the Western countries, by predominantly Britain, France, and so on. And in the modern era, by US imperialism, China's providing investment, China's providing technology, China's providing know-how to build modern infrastructure, to build roads, to build railways, to build bridges, ports, schools, hospitals, energy infrastructure, including green energy, which is very significant. You know, you've got large parts of, for example, sub-Saharan Africa, which currently don't have any energy infrastructure whatsoever. So they need to meet their basic demands. You know, people have domestic demands to have energy, modern energy in their homes, and people have obviously economic and manufacturing and industrial demands to have energy driving their progress. And they've got the opportunity now with Chinese funded and supported green energy programs to leapfrog the whole stage of fossil fuel development, which is incredible. China's building telecoms infrastructure, including like launching satellites for developing countries. Bolivia, for example, got its first space satellite launched with China's assistance just, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, and that's now providing 4G access to the whole country, which is one of the poorest countries in Latin America. And the contrast with the US and China in terms of engagement with the developing world, in terms of engagement with the global South, is just incredibly stark, to the degree that in Baghdad, in Iraq, they've got a popular saying, which is that America bombs, but China builds. Because if you look at those two countries' engagement with Iraq, obviously the US led an illegal war and a genocidal war against Iraq from 2003, in which an estimated 1 million civilians were killed. And they flattened the country. You know, they set its development back by decades, by generations, right? Including, you know, the rates of leukemia and birth defects have gone up because of the amount of depleted uranium that's been dropped. China, on the other hand, like Iraq, is one of the biggest recipients of infrastructure investment under the Belt and Road Initiative. China's currently got a contract to build 7,000 schools in Iraq. And again, they're even building renewable energy infrastructure, which is an incredible thing for a country where, like, the amount of oil it's got under its surface has been the reason that it's had so much kind of unwarranted attention over the course of the last century plus. You know, with Chinese assistance and Chinese investment and Chinese support, Iraq has got the opportunity to become a solar energy superpower. So, you know, what China's overall role, especially through the Belt and Road Initiative, is to allow countries to break out of underdevelopment. And that's a historically very important thing.
Well, in terms of, let's switch back to China, and then I want to come back to the developed world. In terms of China, how do you think, what were some of the processes that you studied in terms of China's ability to raise hundreds of millions of people out of poverty? I mean, how did China do that? Because obviously there's a lot of the rest of the world that would like to replicate some of that miracle, basically.
Yeah. And yeah, that it is a miracle, but also there's no magic wand, and a lot of it comes down to incredibly hard work. You know, certainly there's something to be learned from the level of kind of extreme commitment to the project that was shown by the Chinese leadership, by the Chinese government. And then there are interesting aspects to the methodology. You know, for example, they started off with a kind of year-long process of investigation, right? You know, almost doing a poverty census to identify literally every family in every community that's living below the poverty line, that doesn't have their basic needs met, that, you know, not only under a kind of dollar income threshold, but that doesn't have access to modern energy, or doesn't have access to running water, or doesn't have access to sufficient clothing, food, housing, you know, that maybe the kids don't have access to education, and the family doesn't have access to healthcare, and so on. You know, the Chinese definition of absolute poverty is actually really important, because it's not just moving above a very low kind of internationally defined in cash income threshold. It's also having your basic needs met. And actually, in the developing world, certainly in India, if you're not only above a basic cash income threshold, but you've got adequate food, you've got adequate housing, you've got adequate clothing, you've got running water, you've got modern energy, you know, you've got electricity piped into your home, and your kids go to school, and if something goes wrong health-wise, you can get treatment. I mean, that's practically, you know, you're practically middle class for most of the global South, right? So that's kind of China's definition of not being in absolute poverty, which is an incredible thing. So even now, obviously, you've still got poor people in China, but their level of overall well-being is well above the average, even, that you will find in much of the rest of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. You know, there's a variety of methods that were used. as part of the anti-poverty campaign, to kind of raise people's economic level. Obviously, a big focus on training, a big focus on job creation, on improving access to education, like connecting rural producers up with the national market, using modern technology, using e-commerce, using WeChat and like mobile telecommunications and all the rest of it. Some element of voluntary relocation for people that, you know, living in extremely remote areas. So building new communities that are, you know, that are fully equipped, that have schools, that have medical clinics, that have shops, etc. And, you know, there's the level of commitment and the level of kind of resources that went into the project. You know, that I think the number of cadres went, you know, to remote rural regions to work on this project was like numbered something along the lines of 3 million. So it's a huge, it's an extraordinary and basically unparalleled effort to improve people's lives. But I think the basic pillars of the poverty alleviation campaign, you know, poverty alleviation doesn't start in 2013. It doesn't start with the Extreme Poverty Program. Like, poverty alleviation has been the, you know, the basic kind of founding principle of the CPC, and it's been what it's always done since 1949, and before that, going back to the establishment of the, you know, the Jingang Soviet in the early 1930s and all the rest of it, and in the liberated territories, you know, introducing land reform, introducing healthcare, introducing education, and all the rest of it. You know, the poverty alleviation is very much at the heart of the CPC's ideology and strategy. But, you know, the basic pillars of the poverty alleviation campaign are political. They rely on, you know, the socialist system. They rely on a government that represents the interests of the people. They rely on the capitalist class not being the ruling class, and the, you know, that relatively small group of people that owns and deploys capital not kind of calling the shots and not deciding what's important for the country, what's important for investment. You know, the poverty alleviation also relies on sovereignty. China won its sovereignty in 1949, and that's historically extremely important, and it's protected its sovereignty. And that means that it's allowed to make its own choices. You know, the Chinese government makes choices on behalf of and it, in discussion with and engagement with the masses. And it's got the freedom to do that because it's a socialist country where the capitalist class isn't the ruling class, and it's a sovereign country where it doesn't have to kind of bow to the diktat and the hegemony of the US or Europe or Japan or anywhere else.
You know, I want to confirm some of the things that you said, because I had some firsthand experience going and seeing some of the poverty alleviation. So I went to this place in Shandong, which most people don't associate with being particularly impoverished, but I went to the deep countryside in Shandong, 2014. I went to this woman's house, and she had a well that she had directly in front of her home that was built in the 1960s. And that's where she extracted water. She did not have running plumbing at all. So there was no flushing toilet. She just had an outhouse with a hole that rolled out onto the hillside. So I left, and I heard about in media that China was rolling out, we're going to make sure that everyone has flushing toilets. And I was like, well, this is, you know, kind of a, you know, from an American perspective, this sounds kind of strange, but they're going to make sure 1.3 billion people have flushing toilets. I thought this is very peculiar, and I hope great success. You know, I went back to this woman's home the next year, and she had complete plumbing in her home, running water, faucets. She had a flushing toilet. It was just remarkable. I mean, this was the deep, deep, deep countryside. There's, you know, when you think of a Chinese village, you think, oh, okay, that's 100,000 people. But this village was literally like 50 people. You know, it was like out in the middle of nowhere. And they had, you know, party members had gone out. They'd seen, okay, this is what the needs are. This is how we can do that. And they linked up the entire village, this tiny, tiny village, with all of the requisite, you know, water infrastructure that they need to be brought up to a standard of modernity. So yeah, I think it's really interesting when people say, oh, you know, the international standard for, you know, being raised above poverty in China is only like $2.90 per, you know, day or something. But it's actually, like you said, it's much more than that. You know, she has the ability to pick up the phone and call someone, and, you know, a doctor will come to her home if necessary. You know, like a local physician will actually make a house visit to make sure that she's okay and check on her health. Basic, you know, basic healthcare is provided for her. Water is provided for her. Electricity is provided for her. You know, she lives on one of these old, 1950s sort of collectivized farm areas, but she still has all of the modern amenities that people in other cities have as well. So it's not just about having the basic minimum cash per day, but she has access to all kinds of other social tools. And you also mentioned relocations in some extreme cases. I was in Xinjiang, actually, in Pishan County, and we went to a village that was built by the CPC, by the Communist Party of China. And these were people who had been relocated from generations of squalor living out in the deserts with no access to basic care. And in these, in this case, and sometimes it's you have to relocate, you pay a small fee like 1,000 kuai, 10,000 kuai. But in this case, people were given free apartments. They were literally given an apartment with running water, running electricity. You know, it was easier just to relocate all of these people that were living impoverished conditions for generations, to just put them all in a community where there are modern buildings, modern school, modern hospital, everything that these people needed in order to raise them above poverty. So all of the kinds of examples that you used in your discourse, you know, I've seen a lot of that personally with my own eyes. I've talked to people who live in these communities. I've smelled the air in these communities, and it's exactly what you're talking about. The amount of effort that went into raising this many people out of poverty across a country the size of China, it is beyond remarkable. And, you know, I think historians are going to be studying this example as long as there is any poverty in the world, because the tools and the processes that China used, hopefully, in some cases, can be used elsewhere where the need is still there. We have a lot to talk about in little time. I'm going to move on.
If you don't mind, I just mentioned one, I think, just zooming out. In terms of poverty alleviation, there's another factor that's worthy of mention, which is that in Chinese villages, even the poorest Chinese villages, people still own their own land. You know, people still have their own plots of land, and they're not subject to landlords, and they're not in debt bondage. You know, if you go in most other places in the developing world, certainly in Asia, and you go to the villages, people are trying to escape debt bondage, you know, sometimes multi-generational debt bondage. You know, they're still ground down by essentially a feudal system, and they escape the village and they end up in peri-urban slums. In India's case, you know, if you can see peri-urban slums on the outskirts of Delhi, on the outskirts of Mumbai and many other cities, and China doesn't have any of that. And a big part of the reason is that, you know, China had a very thoroughgoing anti-feudal revolution that got rid of the feudal land system and gave land to, you know, to the ordinary people. So even poor people in remote rural areas still own their own land. And if they need to, you know, they can still kind of sustain themselves from their land, which is a very important difference with many other parts of the developing world. Oh, yeah.
You're listening to The Bridge.
You know, a mutual friend, a friend of yours, Mick Dunford, Professor Mick Dunford from the University of Sussex, I had him on the show. We're really off of the script, but it's okay because this stuff is really interesting. He made a really interesting point that I had not conceived of until I interviewed him. In fact, before I was about to interview him, he told me, I want to correct you about one of the bullet points you want to discuss with me. I said, no, do it on the air. Correct me on the air so that the listeners can be corrected too. So, you know, they know that this is a common misconception. And one of the things that I had in my mind was, since 1990, that China had, you know, raised everyone out of poverty, you know, 800 million people or whatever. And he corrected me and he said, that's not an accurate representation of China's economic history. Because right from the beginning, like you mentioned, right from 1950, moving forward, people were already being raised out of poverty. And this is a misconception that the West has. During collectivization, when people were released from these feudal arrangements, they were given access to their own land, to their own farming, and to a large extent, they were able to provide for themselves, you know, in non-measurable economic terms, what they did not have before: access to food, access to water, access to, you know, sustainability. A lot of it was, yes, farming for themselves, but they had access to food and water, and they were able to clothe themselves. And so poverty dramatically dropped as soon as the CPC took power in China. And so a lot of Westerners like to say, wow, China raised all these people out of poverty after Deng Xiaoping switched to an open market. But that's not an accurate representation of what happened in China. That is a representation of how the economy is measured from 1989, 1990 to now. So yes, China did raise hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, but it didn't start in 1990. It started in 1950. And I think that is something that a lot of people miss. And I think it's a, you know, something you pointed out. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. We do need to move forward. I do want to ask these other questions. So you recently gave a speech at a roundtable discussion on Venezuela's foreign policy in a changing world at the Bolivar Hall in London, organized by the ambassador of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. And you said, Chinese loans have been crucial for Venezuela's development over the past two decades, and Chinese investment and cooperation are helping to create space for Venezuela to modernize. Now, one of the arguments that we hear in the West, in Western media, is debt trap, and that China, oh, don't take loans from China. You're going to be, you know, beholden to them forever. So could you elaborate how that may be a distortion or a misrepresentation of how China's finance works in the developing world?
Of course. I mean, it's pretty easy for people to make accusations. So, the starting point is you have to look at who's making the accusations, who's saying these things, because it's not actually the recipient countries that are talking about debt traps. You can ask, people and politicians in Sri Lanka. You can ask people and politicians in Bolivia or in Venezuela or in Congo or Zimbabwe, and they don't talk about debt traps. You know, they talk about investment and they talk about trade and they talk about things that their governments and their societies want and need. And ultimately, I see this label of debt trap as part of a propaganda war. And it's a narrative that's used by the leading imperialist powers. It's something that Hillary Clinton often talked about. It's something that Rex Tillerson talked about. It's something that Mike Pompeo talked about. It's something that Antony Blinken talked about. China issues loans, just like many other countries do, and many other financial institutions. But there's nothing particularly out of the ordinary about those loans. Actually, there's a Britain-based debt justice charity who did a major study last year, and they found that actually Chinese loans typically perform very well. They have a much lower interest rate, about half the average interest rate when compared with Western lending institutions, and with much longer and much more flexible repayment terms. Chinese loans come without conditionality, which is extremely important and, contrasts quite starkly with World Bank and IMF loans, which are famous or notorious, I should say, for, structural adjustment programs for forcing privatization and deregulation. You want this emergency loan so that you can feed your people and avoid a famine. Well, you'll have to accede to like privatization of your water system or deregulation of your energy systems so that, Western companies can penetrate that market and so on. And furthermore, Chinese loans almost invariably go for projects that are like helping countries to modernize, that are helping them to build out their infrastructure, that are helping them to upgrade their economies. So, taking a loan is typically seen as a good investment for the recipient. And there have been lots of scare stories about China like taking over loan collateral to compromise other countries' sovereignty. We had this bizarre story a couple of years ago about an airport in Kampala that had allegedly been taken over by the Chinese, or the famous Hambantota port in Sri Lanka. But these stories have all been comprehensively debunked, so they just end up being lies and slanders. And ultimately,
this is a topic that is really dear to my heart. I think it's really important because what is at stake are the lives of billions of people. And so I would like to, maybe in the future, I could have you back on the show and we could talk specifically about the difference between World Bank and Belt and Road and China's development, underdeveloped nations, what's best for them, what's in their best interest, because this topic is critical. And probably it's one of the most important topics that we could be talking about at this time, not just because of Sino-US relations or Sino-EU relations, but because so many human lives are at stake. So I would definitely like to flesh these topics out with you and other guests in the future. So it's definitely something I want to come back around to.
Great.
Well, one of the hot, you mentioned climate, the climate, it's an important topic for you. It's an important topic for me. I come from California. We're all hippies out there, as everyone knows. And so, China is now manufacturing EVs, solar, wind, batteries, semiconductors, and so forth. how, and right now, you know, the US, UK, EU, they're complaining. Oh, no, we can't compete. So it's your fault, China, because you're making these things too fast. So is this the fault of China outdeveloping global competitors? What is your take?
I mean, in as much as it's a competition, you can't really blame China for winning that competition. You know, the US is very much in favor of competition as long as it's winning. All of a sudden, China's winning and the US thinks that the rules of the game have changed. You know, China has invested very heavily in this area, and it's invested very heavily in new productive forces because it wants to upgrade its economy and it doesn't want to kind of permanently occupy a subordinate position in the global economy, you know, manufacturing cheap consumer goods for Western markets. And that sort of feels reasonable and understandable. And China can, you know, China can do that. China is a huge country, and it's a country where, as we've discussed, like the government is in charge and the government is able to kind of pull the major levers of the economy. So China can decide that it's important to develop solar power, and it can order a suitable kind of structure of loans and subsidies and incentives to be able to do that. And frankly, thank goodness, because if you look at the rest of the world, it's been a global consensus, right, for 30 years plus, since the early 90s at least, since the Rio summit. It's been understood at the UN level and in terms of international law that we're facing a climate crisis and that we need urgent remedial action in relation to that. But we've made almost no progress.
But, you know, we don't have a lot of time. I have one last question I like to ask all my guests, and, you know, we'll have to keep it a little brief. Obviously, we're both peace activists. So what, in your thinking, can be done to deepen Sino-US-UK-EU relations? Last
question. Sure. I mean, I think there are a few different aspects. And I, like, for example, with the business community, I think we have to appeal to the bottom line. Like, there's money to be made in China. There's clear benefits to investing in China, receiving investment from China, trading with China. And if you look at the dynamic, like particularly between the US and China at the moment, the problem comes at the political level. Actually, businesses are calling for more cooperation with China. You know, businesses want to invest in China. They want to sell their products in China. You know, China's got a middle-income market of 500 million people. That's a very big and a very important market. And most sensible capitalists in the United States and Britain and Europe want some involvement in that market. So in their terms, the whole campaign of encirclement and containment and this new Cold War doesn't make a lot of sense at the level of the bottom line. So that's an important aspect to keep in mind. For the working class, for trade unions, well, Chinese investment means more jobs. The Chinese market means more jobs. You know, the new Cold War on China doesn't serve working class people in Britain or the US. It doesn't serve like ordinary communities. It doesn't meet their needs in any way. You know, like because of Chinese surveillance scare stories, in Britain, we're removing Huawei from our network infrastructure. The only result is that we're going to be paying more for worse network infrastructure. So we're suffering because of this, you know, completely kind of misguided and what will ultimately be completely unsuccessful attempt to suppress China's development. I think for progressives and for climate activists in particular, let's say we've got to work with China on climate change. We've got to work with China on biodiversity. You know, last year, China was responsible for 55% of all investment in renewable energy globally, right? 55%, whereas China's population is 17 or 18% of the global total. So it's punching well above its weight in those terms, in terms of this kind of shared human project of saving the planet. So, you know, and what are we going to say when that 55% is 60% or 70% or 80%? Can people who care about the future of the Earth really say, oh, we're not going to work with China? You know, China's leading the way. China's the superpower when it comes to addressing the climate crisis, when it comes to forestation, when it comes to protecting biodiversity, when it comes to addressing pollution of rivers, seas, land, and so on. So with progressives and climate activists, I think that's kind of the scene for intervention. Let's work with China on climate change. Let's work with China on the environmental crisis. With peace activists, you know, with people who don't want a kind of nuclear holocaust, let's make sure the Cold War doesn't become a hot war. Let's build a mass movement to get rid of AUKUS, and to get rid of the Quad and to stop this trajectory towards a global NATO and to stop incitement of tensions on along the Taiwan Straits and so on. And in general, you know, let's stop treating China as a threat. Let's stop portraying it as the, you know, this kind of dystopian hellscape, which is so completely at odds with the reality of China. Let's, you know, be decent human beings. Let's accept the Chinese people as equals. Let's accept that the world is moving in a direction of multipolarity, which is a fundamentally fairer and more equal and a more democratic and a more peaceful system of international relations. Let's accept that the project for the new American century is a dream. It's a chimera. It's not going to happen. And let's move forward, you know, on the basis of cooperation and friendship. And that's what China's putting on the table. You know, that's what China wants, and that's what China is offering the West. So the ball is kind of in our court as to whether we take that up.
Amazingly well said. I feel actually rejuvenated from your speech. That was fantastic. I hope we can have you back on the show. Thank you so much for your time. Carlos Martinez, you can find Carlos Martinez on X at agent_of_change, agent of change. Thank you so much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Jason. Oh, yeah.